V'haraaf kaved ba'aretz. The drought is very intense, very heavy on the land. And in verse number 2, when they finished eating everything they had brought from Egypt, at the end of the verse it says that the father told the sons, go buy more food. In verse number 3, Vayomer Elav Yehuda Lemor. Yehuda turns to his father and says, we can't go. He'id banu ha'ish lemor, the man told us, Lo tiru panai bilti achichem itchem, don't come and see me unless you bring your brother. And you're not willing to allow us to bring along Binyamin. So why are you telling us to go? Verse number 4, Im yeshcha meshaleach et achinu itanu, but if you agree to send Binyamin with us, neirda, then we will go. V'nishberu lecha ochel, then we can get food. V'meincha meshaleach lo neirid, but if you don't agree to send Binyamin, I mean, that's your choice, we can force you to do it, but whether to go or not go, we won't listen to you. You remember we spoke about the center of power being given over to the children. Now Yehuda makes the decision. They decide whether they should go to Egypt or not. So they decide, we are not going to Egypt unless you agree to send Binyamin with us. Now, listen carefully to the dialogue in verse number 6 and 7. Remember, Torah is not a book of curiosities, of historical curiosities. If it's in Torah, it has an eternal value. It's a lesson for eternity. So if we find every once in a while certain statements that which seem absolutely irrelevant, a statement which is good to satisfy our curiosity about the relationship between Yaakov and his sons, but it doesn't teach us anything. This is the type of a statement which comes up now in verse number 6. It seems absolutely an irrelevant addition to the dialogue that the Torah could have skipped. Vayomer Israel, and Israel says, now it's even more significant because whenever the Torah wants to tell us something where it's specifically stressed that this has to do not with Jacob, the father of the tribes, but with Israel, the father of the nation of Israel. So here if it says Vayomer Israel, it doesn't say Vayomer Yaakov, as it did before. Here it says Israel, Israel. So listen to what the Torah quotes. Lama hareotem li, why did you do harm to me? What? Lehagid la'ish ha'od lachemach. Why did you tell him that you have a younger son?
Brother.
I'm a younger brother.
What does it say, younger?
Well, okay, you're right. No, younger brother. Another brother. Ha'od lachemach, that you have another brother. He could have said that that's all. What is Yaakov accusing them of? There's something wrong with saying you have another brother.
What?
But what's wrong? What did they say? They said, you know, we used to be 12 in the family, now we are 11. The younger one is with his father. We are here. What's wrong? He's accusing them. Not only is he accusing them, he's calling it Lama Hareyotim. Ra, why did you do evil? What evil did they do by not concealing that they have another brother? What's wrong? You have a problem here. What? Why?
Right. To get something for themselves. To get themselves off the hook.
Why? Why was it? No, just the opposite. And listen to the answer. Yehuda gives the logical answer. Of course, he says Vayomru. So they all answered Shaol Shaol Haish Lanu L'Molatenu. The men asked us about us. L'moladetenu means l'holid, having children, which means our family ties. L'mor, ha'od avichem chai, he asked, is your father still alive? Ha'yesh lachem ach, do you have another brother? Wanna get lost? So we answered him. We answered him. He asked us, what should we do? Lie? Why should we have lied? Wanna get lost? Al pi advarim ha'ele. Hayadoa neida ki yomar horidu tachichem. We were supposed to guess that he's going to say, ah, you have another brother, bring him here. How are we supposed to guess that that's what he's going to ask us? If we would have guessed, of course, you know, we would have said that we don't have another brother. Lying is no problem if you are going to save a life. If you really think that Binyamin's life is in danger. So of course you don't mention that you have a brother, but how are we supposed to know? I mean, this is a good answer, and Yaakov accepts the answer. It's a good answer. The problem is the question. Why does the Torah record a question which on the surface has no basis? It's only based on a mistake. Yaakov didn't know that Yosef had asked them, do you have another brother? Because once they answer, he asked us and we had no reason to lie. Should we lie without a reason? Yaakov is satisfied. He doesn't continue criticizing them. No, you should have realized, you stupid children of mine. No, he didn't say that, which means he's satisfied. So why does the Torah mention that he asked the question? So I must tell you that the Amik Dovor, one of the great classic commentaries on the Torah, the Netzivrim Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, he says there is a very, very important principle. It's so important that the Torah says, Vayomer Israel. It's something that Klal Israel, it's not Israel, Jacob, the father of the tribes that's speaking now. It's Israel, the father of the Jewish people, giving a lesson to his children that is going to be relevant and important forever. What is the lesson that Yaakov is telling them? As Jews, when you are in exile, right, you'll have a tendency of offering uncalled for information. Like, who are you for? Are you for or against the president? Are you? Do you believe in this or do you believe in that? Don't give any unnecessary information. Don't reveal anything which is not absolutely necessary. Don't give away the position of the Jews in exile. Don't give them any information which is not absolutely necessary. On the surface it seems so strange. Why not? Why not? So it says, because this is the nature of the relationship between Jew and Gentile in exile. Any information that the Jews gives out, uncalled for, eventually that information will be turned around against the Jew. That is a basic rule in the relationship between Jew and Gentile. You offer any position which is not absolutely crucial in order to survive, and then eventually, a few years later, they'll turn around, didn't you say that you were such and such, that you believed in such and such, that you were for such and such a person? Now things were turned around, so now we are against you. This is the lesson of the question. So if you pay attention, when he says, Vayomer Israel, Lama hareyotem li, why did you do harm to me? Why did you give out any information which is not absolutely crucial? So when they answer, well, we were asked, and therefore that's what we answer, say, okay, fine. But the lesson is in the question that you should know from now on. Never give out any information concerning our position, the position of the Jewish people, unless absolutely necessary. And Jewish history proves how right this is. It always happens. It always happens that whenever Jews come out too strongly for a certain person, let's say in the politics of a certain country, eventually that position will be turned around and used against the Jews. Yeah. Well, so that's the point, meaning the lesson is already given. Don't forget, Yaakov is not just trying to make them feel badly. He's trying to give them a lesson for the future. So in the future, they will know to think more closely about the possible consequences of anything that on the surface doesn't seem important. Now, next time, if such a situation will arise, the sons will ask themselves, wait a second, he's asking us, do we have another brother? Wait a second, why should we give him the information? Which means that Yaakov is not really criticizing them, but he's teaching them a lesson how to behave in the future. Yeah.
Is
That doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. Don't forget the pattern here. No. The pattern of the behavior of the tribes towards Yosef, right, is not the pattern of the behavior of a Jew against Jew. It's Jew against Gentile, because in their minds, that's a Gentile. That doesn't matter. Fine, so that is a separate issue. But what Yaakov tells his sons, it doesn't matter. What Yaakov tells his sons how to behave towards Yosef is something that we have to derive from it, lessons in how to behave towards people in power, Gentiles in power, not Jews in power, Gentiles in power, right? Sometimes it could be that we can apply it even in about the Jews in power, if the Jews act like Gentiles. Right? That's true. There are some Jews who act like Gentiles, and we are supposed to behave towards them as we behave towards Gentiles, right? That's the case by Yosef in this case. Okay, let's go on. So now Yehuda is going to convince his father to allow him to be the guarantor for Binyamin's well-being. This is what he tells him in verse number 8, and in verse number 9, and in verse number 10. The main word here is in verse number 9. Anochi e'erveno, to be an orev. Orev means a guarantor. If somebody borrows money and he puts he asks a guarantor to sign on the document, he's called an orev. This is an erveno. I am his guarantor. Miyadi tevakshenu, the same way that on a loan, if the borrower doesn't pay back, you go straight to the guarantor. She says miyadi tevakshenu. Anything happens, you come to me. This is what Yehuda says. I'm the guarantor. And his father goes along with the idea. He becomes the guarantor. And now I just want to give you a little bit of an insight.
What's the penalty? He's the guarantor, but what's the penalty?
Doesn't say. It doesn't say. It's interesting. It doesn't say. So and what happens if not? Doesn't say. But I just want to give you a little bit of an insight into this idea of the guarantor. Remember, Masei Avot Siman Levadim, everything that happens now has consequences in all of the history of the Jewish people. What consequences does this relationship between Yehuda and Binyamin? Binyamin is the person which is important, and Yehuda is the guarantor. What consequences will that relationship have in the future history of the Jewish people? Enormous consequences. As a matter of fact, you know why Binyamin, we mentioned why Binyamin is so important. Binyamin is the only product, at least in the mind of Yaakov at this time, the only product of his perfect soulmate, Rochel. That's Binyamin. So this is why he sees Binyamin as crucial in the survival of the Jewish people. Remember, we mentioned this in the past. Maybe we can lose Shimon. That's very bad and very sad. But losing Shimon is not losing the whole of the Jewish people. Losing Binyamin is losing the whole of the Jewish people. Binyamin is left by himself. That's the word used by Yaakov. Levado. He is alone. He is the essence, the quintessential Yaakov, the quintessential Jew is Binyamin. And if he is lost, the whole thing is lost. It's interesting that you know what happens when there is a civil war in Israel, and the northern tribes secede from the southern tribes. You know who remains on the southern tribes?
Yehuda and Binyamin.
Listen to the partnership. Yehuda and Binyamin. The essence, which is Binyamin, and the guarantor, Yehuda. Right? This is not the only time that we see such a relationship. Yeah? Well, it's not only that, but this capacity. Remember we mentioned the fact that Yaakov says, he remains alone, levado, alone. Binyamin has the capacity to remain alone. We never find in the history of the Jewish people one tribe which has that capacity to go it alone, but the tribe of Benjamin. It's exactly the situation that you mentioned now. In the book of Judges, we find that the tribe of Benjamin fights against everybody else. Everybody else. Where is that strength? Of course, they were wrong in doing it. It doesn't matter. But the idea is, where do they derive that strength to go it alone? To feel that they are the essence. The main thing is that they should survive. It's misused, this idea. Of course, you can distort any ideology. And that ideology of Benjamin being the essence of the Jewish people can be distorted too. To the point that you feel, who needs the rest? As long as we survive, that's sufficient. That's exactly what happened in the book of Judges. Remember the story. In the tribe of Benjamin, something happened in a certain city. A person came, was mistreated by the people of the city. It was a city in the state of Benjamin. And as a matter of fact, he was so mistreated that his concubine, they raped his concubine. And because of the pain of being raped, she died. And he took the body of his concubine, this man, and he divided it up into 12 parts, and he sent one piece of his concubine, of the flesh, of the body of his concubine. Just, it's a real shocker. And that's what he wanted, to shock the people into action, to each one of the tribes of Israel, saying, are you going to allow that this people of Givon, that's the name of the city, are they going to be forgiven? Are we going to ignore the terrible thing that they did? And the Jews got together and they decided, no, we have to, you know, justice has to be done. And they came to the city of Givon, and you know what the answer was? You are going to tell us what to do? We are Benjamin. You hear the idea? You hear the distortion of the importance of Benjamin? And they say, we are going to do what we want. Nobody is going to tell us what to do. But we are your fellow Jews. So what if you are my fellow Jews? We are Benjamin. We can go it alone. You hear the distortion of this idea? But it all stems from the idea of Benjamin being the essence of Israel. And they fight. They fight against the whole of Israel. And they lose. They lose. But they survive. Not only do they survive, but it was a terrible civil war. It was a terrible war, and at the end, they allowed the tribe of Israel to come back into the Jewish fold, right? And they have descendants because we can't afford that the tribe of Israel should be lost from the Jewish people. I'm sorry, the tribe of Benjamin to be lost from the Jewish people. Now, there's something else. Do you know that the main goal of the Jewish people in this world is to overcome evil? But we know that evil became absorbed into certain people. The same way that goodness became absorbed by us, by the Jewish people. Avraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov. Specifically Yaakov, he's the concentration of all the goodness of Avraham and Yitzhak and Yaakov. He's the Nivchar Sheba'ovos. He's the chosen one. He's the one that absorbs all which is good. At the same time, there is an absorption in the other pole, in the other direction. Who is that? Amalek, Esav. The goal of the Jewish people is to destroy Amalek, to destroy the evil in the world, which takes the form of Amalek in this world of ours, right? That's our goal. Who was given the job in Israel? You know, the first one who is given that job?
King Saul.
King Saul is given the job, right? As a matter of fact, he's the first king of Israel, because that's the job of the king of Israel. The king of Israel is supposed to bring about the redemption of the world, the rectification of evil. In order to do that, you have to destroy Amalek. Right? He fails. He doesn't do a good job. So Benjamin fails in his job. Who is the backup system? Remember, there is a Yehuda. Who is that?
King David.
King David, Mashiach, he's supposed to do the job that Shaul failed in. Shaul failed.
David was a Binyan.
No.
Yehuda.
David is Yehuda.
I lived in Binyan.
It's David is Yehuda. Shevet Yehuda. Mashiach ben David is which Shevet? Yehuda. Except that's always the problem. When the borrower doesn't pay back and you have to go to the guarantor, then it becomes much more difficult. If Shaul HaMelech would have done his job, then the rectification of evil would have been done, you know, thousands of years ago. He didn't do it, so there is a whole long, long process that we have to go through. It would have been much, much easier had Binyamin done a good job. But he didn't do it, so then his guarantor has to take care of it. Yeah?
You say that Esau represents evil. You mean he represents the
Esau again?
The
well, listen to this statement in the Gemara. Who Esau, who was Sotan, who are Malchamoves, who are Yetzer Hara? Right? Sure, I mean, we believe that Esau, we don't mean all of Esau. We mean within Esau there is a group. We call it Amalek within Esau. Within Esau there is the polarization of good and evil took the form of certain people. Right? The same way, right? Evil and goodness before used to be like alternatives that everybody can be good. But after there would be, there was a polarization of good and evil, then the good of the world became concentrated on one side and the evil on another side. So as soon as there is a Yaakov, there has to be a counterforce to Yaakov. Right? So. Yes, but in order to do that, those people who represent the evil inclination, who are the embodiment of the evil inclination, which means the embodiment of the Satan, the embodiment of the Sitra Acharov, of the other side, they have to be destroyed. Of course, of course. So the destruction doesn't have to be a bodily destruction. You have to go and kill them. What about if they all do tshuva, then you don't have to kill anybody. But assuming that they don't do tshuva, then those people who represent that evil, right, those have to be destroyed. Otherwise, there can be a redemption. There can be a redemption. That was the throne of God. That's the way we describe the redemption. That the throne of God will be complete, full. In order for that to happen, Amalek has to cease to exist. Because as long as he exists, the throne of God is not complete. Right? That's the idea behind it. Yeah.
Where is that book Gemara that they just quoted us?
Which one?
The one that says that the Esav is Malchamoves.
Oh, that's a... well, it's admitted the Yalkut Shimon. He says it, by the way, in Breishis. That's a Yalkut Shimon in Breishis. It really, it is in that Gemara. I can't remember where the Gemara is. But the Yalkut Shimon says it in Breishis. Right in the beginning, in the first chapter, he says, "Who are Malachamovis? Who are Sotan? Who Esau?" He says. All right. So this gives you a little bit of an insight into this relationship of guarantor. It always remains that way. Binyamin and Yehuda is the guarantor. Even in the Beis Hamikdash, the Kodesh HaKodoshim, by the way, the Holy of Holies. You know where it is, the Holy of Holies. That's in Binyamin. It's in Binyamin because the Holy of Holies represents the essence, and the essence is Binyamin. But next to Binyamin has to be Yehuda. So Yehuda and Binyamin are together. Okay, they survive together. And as long as Binyamin survives and Yehuda survives, we say the Jewish people are surviving. What about the other 10 tribes? Fine, they are around. They are not going to be lost. Even though there are opinions which say, well, you know, so they are lost. Lost doesn't mean that all members of those tribes are lost, by the way. It just means that as tribes they are lost. As long as Binyamin is around and Yehuda is around, then the Jewish people are around. Do you hear this idea? Again, the same idea. Binyamin is the essence and Yehuda is the guarantor.
What about Levi?
Levi has another job. Levi has another job. Remember, Levi doesn't have an actual part, a physical part. He has another job. But the essence of Klal Yisrael, of course you need the Levim, but the essence of Klal Yisrael is Binyamin. Right? Now, let's go on. They come to Yosef. They bring him presents. Let's skip a little bit. In verse number 16, Shishi, Tetzayin. Vayar Yosef itam et Binyamin. And as soon as Yosef sees with them Binyamin, Vayomer lasher al beito, he says to the one taking care of his household, bring him to my house. Utvoach tevach vehachein. Utvoach tevach means prepare food. Vehachein, and make it ready. Vehachein, achana, be ready. Says the Midrash, vehachein, vehachein, preparing, preparation. This is a word, this is a code word. What does the word vehachein into? Something which is mentioned later on in Parshat Beshalach in Exodus. Veheichinu, you know what you have to prepare for? What does it ring a bell? Preparing. For which meal do you have to prepare? For Shabbos, right? Ve'ichinu, ve'hochein. Ve'hochein is something that has to do with Shabbos, preparation for Shabbos. Says the Midrash, this was a Shabbos meal. And we say, so what relevance does it have, whether it was Friday or Wednesday or Shabbos? No, somehow it's important. It's Shabbos. Okay, let's go on. And in verse number 17, Vayasu ish kasher omar Yosef, that's what he did. He brought them all to Yosef's house. In verse number 18, Vayiru anoshim kivu bet Yosef, and they were scared. Why are we being brought to the Yosef? Probably he's going to accuse us of being thieves, and he wants to do it directly just to scare us more. But that's not what happened at all. At the end, we're skipping a little bit. In verse number 24, at this point already, Shimon already was presented to them. He's safe and sound and healthy. And Vayoveo Ishet Anashim Beita Yosef, they brought him to Yosef. They washed their feet. They give food to the animals. No, not yet. Now they have no idea who it is. So then they come in verse number 26, Vayovo Yosef Abaita, and Yosef comes to his house. Vayoviu lo et amincha asher biyadam abaita, vayishtachavu lo arza, and they all bow down to him. How many people are bowing down to him? 11. Binyamin is with them.
Binyamin.
11. Say the commentaries, here it is, the fulfillment of what?
Prophecy
number one. Prophecy number one, over. Fulfilled. That's it. Yeah.
Now
the 11 started, the 11 stalks. The 11 stalks. Yeah. The second prophecy demands what else? The sun and the moon, that's the problem. So Yosef has to think fast of a method, the same way he got Benjamin to come and fulfill dream number one, he has to fulfill dream number two. So, what is he going to do? He's going to keep Benjamin here and make sure that his father comes, right? That his father comes to get him, and in this way he can fulfill dream number two. The moon will be, Yaakov will come with his family. That means his stepmother. Remember, we spoke about the fact that his stepmother Bila will come. So they come, and in verse number 27, Vayishalem leshalom, Vayimar shalom avichem azaken. Is your father okay? Is he still alive? Vayimar shalom labdecho, denuchai, still alive. And then in verse number 29, Vayisaina vayaret Binyamin achiv, he lifts his eyes, he sees Binyamin, and he says to them, is this your little brother, Hazeachichemakaton, Asher Martem Elai. What's their answer? No answer. How come there's no answer? Vayomar Elokim Yachnechabni. So the commentaries say, what does it mean? This is a rhetorical question. I thought he's really young. You keep saying about he's so young, we can't bring him because he's so young. Right? He was well in his 30s already. What do you mean? He wasn't a young child. So this is what he meant rhetorically. This is the young child that you were afraid to bring along. But don't worry, it's okay. Even if he's older, you know, I'm still giving him a blessing. Elokim Yachnechabni. And then he went out of the room. It's already, he's struggling within himself. Some part of him wants to reveal himself to them, but there is another part that's fighting that desire to control himself. Obviously, what might be the reason why he wants to control that desire to cry out and reveal himself? The fulfillment of the second dream. Remember, that's the crucial point. So in verse number 31, it says, Vayechatz panav vayetzeh, he washes his face, vayitapak, he controls himself. Which means he really desires to reveal himself, but he realizes that he shouldn't. Read something else which is very strange. Vayeshu lefanav, each one sat down, and there were assigned seats. Habechor kibechorato, the bechor, the oldest one, had a specific place. Veatzair ketzirato, and another place for the younger one, and the one after that. So they realized that there was there is somebody here who knows exactly the positions of each one. In the Midrash it says that it doesn't say HaBechor Kezignato, according to his age. It means each one according to his position. The position number one was given to Yehuda. Then Reuven. Then another son. And then another son. You know, each one realized that the position that he was given was because there is some information that somebody has, and they had no idea whom, because it can be a coincidence, because they realize that each one belongs in the place that he was seated. Do you hear? What's the importance of that? What was Yosef trying to bring out? What's the point? Aha, I know something that you don't. What's the point? I mean, he doesn't want them to suspect that he's Yosef, true? So you can say that the reason why he was doing it is in order to put the suspicion in his mind, perhaps he's Yosef. That can't possibly be. He's trying to conceal the fact that he's Yosef. So why is he doing that? Right. Question. And it says at the end of verse number 33, Vaitmehu anoshim ishel reyeyu. They were surprised. Now, do you realize the word ish el re'ehu is a little bit redundant? Nothing is added by the words ish el re'ehu. Do you realize that it would be sufficient to say vayitmehu anoshim? And they were very surprised. What is the ish el re'ehu? Do you realize that it's extra? Doesn't add anything to the understanding of the verse. Okay, let's put it aside. Let's go on. So we have a few problems here. Why Shabbos is very important in the whole story? What is Yosef trying to bring out, to show with this sitting each one down in the proper place? Let's go on. And the words Ishel Reyehu, we don't understand. You know what the word Reyehu means? What? Right, his friend, somebody very close to you. It's Reyehu, right? Somebody close to you.
When you translate the Ishel is that one brother to his brothers?
One to his friend, to his close friend.
It's not talking about a specific one, is it? It's talking about all of them to each other?
I guess so, right? I mean, if they are all shocked, they were all surprised, they would say, each one was surprised, El Reyehu. You know, it's why change it to El Reyehu? Why not say Ochicho? You mean, that's an added question that you are adding. You should say Ish El Ochiv, right? Because usually, I mean, they are brothers, why call them Reyehu? Okay? And then in verse number 34, Vayisam masot meit panav alehim vater masat binyamin masot kulam chamesh yadot. He gave each one a portion, a present, whatever it was, and he gave Binyamin five times as much as he gave everybody else. Okay? Vayishtu, and they drank. Vayishkeru, and they got drunk. Imo, together with Yosef. What's the point? What's the point? So here we have an oral tradition. Rashi brings down. You know why they got drunk? Because when you're not used to drinking, right? You drink a little bit and you get drunk. For a long, long time, neither of them, none of the brothers nor Yosef, did they even taste a drop of wine. Since they sold Yosef, they became Nazirim. They abstained from wine. That was part of the process of tshuva. For Yosef, it's because of his what the suffering that he's going through is away from his family. For the brothers, because they already regretted it. Already from the beginning, we see a beginning of regret, and it was expressed with that they stopped drinking wine. Right? So that's what Rashi says over here. In verse number 34, Vayishkrimo umiyom shemachru lo shatu yain, vehu shata yain, velohu shata yain. Ve'oto hayom shatu, and this is the first time that they drank wine. So the obvious question here is,
why?
Why do they start drinking wine now? So as far as Yosef is concerned, we can justify Yosef. Why? He's with his family again. But they don't know that they are with his family. Why did they start drinking wine? Okay? So you say, well, perhaps, but that sense was sufficient to break that vow. Obviously, it was like a vow. What's the idea behind it? So I seen some of the commentaries, they say, well, they had to drink wine because if you are invited to the president or somebody very important and he's drinking wine and you don't, right, he'll be very insulted. So that's why you are not. Well, it doesn't satisfy. There must be more to it than that. So, yeah.
So you said
the patriarchs and their sons and the patriarchs kept most of the exposed?
Well, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So drinking wine with the Gentiles,
Paul, that's what you mean, that they drinking wine. You see, the problem is, according to the biblical law, is not Gentile wine. There is no prohibition against Gentile wine according to the biblical law. It's only wine which is used for idolatry or was put aside for idolatrous use. Right? Now, so you're going to say, well, but there's still a rabbinical prohibition to drink wine that was touched by the Gentile, and that's a rabbinical prohibition.
Well, but there...
This is only, what about if no idolatrous use was made? Then there is no biblical prohibition. That's, you know, just the halakha. That's the halakha. If no idolatrous use was made, let's say a person who is an idolater, he makes wine, you can drink his wine. You're not allowed to drink his wine according to the biblical law if it was put aside for the purpose of presenting it to a certain idol. So they probably checked, right? That's easy to believe that. They checked on that, right? Was this ever used for idol worship? So probably they were satisfied that it wasn't. But what about the rabbinical prohibition? You see, the rabbinical prohibition, this is only, it was made during the Second Temple, the rabbinical prohibition against drinking wine with Gentiles is in order not to socialize with them, right? But this is only after Matan Torah, right? But before Matan Torah, let's say, what is the point of not socializing with them? Because at the end you'll end up marrying them. So let's say you end up marrying a Gentile woman, right, before Matan Torah, and she becomes part of your family. That is a conversion. That's a natural conversion. So therefore, that rabbinical prohibition, right, didn't apply before Matan Torah. Right? It was an automatic conversion, which means a woman who marries into the family of the tribes, of the Jewish people, and she enters into the family, that is the conversion before Matan Torah.
Before Matan Torah. Even the
sure. But there, those rabbinical laws, right, that the reason for them didn't apply then, that they didn't have a need to fulfill, right? So they were allowed to drink. Okay, but again, so we have the problem of the Shabbos, the problem of the choosing the places, of the division of the places, and we have the problem of Ish El Re'ehu, and we have the problem of why do the brothers all of a sudden start drinking wine again. So I saw in a very, very interesting Hasidic commentary, he says the following. You know why they stop drinking wine? You know, it says when a person sees that there is some, you know, usually we say that a person is allowed to drink wine. Why not? God gave it to you. Enjoy it. But what about if you realize that you are becoming a servant to the wine? You're becoming a slave to the wine. Right? So at that point, the only way to regain your control over your life is only by abstaining. You have no choice. What about if there are other forces that you see are overtaking your life? You are losing control over your life. It can be other forces. Like, for instance, jealousy. You're becoming a very jealous person. So again, we also believe that by the abstention of wine, that since the Torah talks about anozir, specifically, if you are going to abstain of something, it's good for your willpower to abstain from wine. Somehow the abstention from wine will develop your willpower, and through that you'll be able to regain control over your life, and therefore your flaws will possibly be overcome. Now, what was the main flaw of the brothers of Yosef?
They sold them.
It was jealousy. They were jealous. True? Jealousy. Now, what is always the symptom of jealousy? Somebody gets something that you don't have, whether he gets physically more, materially more, his position is more higher than yours, and it bothers you. It bothers you. That is the symptom. When something inside of you says, oh boy, I can't stand the fact that, whatever that little voice is within you, you know you are suffering from jealousy. The question is, right, what happened now that made him decide we overcame it?
Binyamin got five portions.
Exactly. First of all, Binyamin got five portions, and they didn't get. And say, hey, it didn't bother me. They looked at each other, and they said to each other, hey, we still feel as close to each other as ever before. Where does it say that? Ish el re'ehu. Doesn't say brothers. It says more than brothers. Closeness. Re'ehu implies closeness. So you see that we are not suffering from our sickness anymore. Hey, we overcame it. We came back. You know what Shabbos represents? Shabbos is very closely related to tshuva. When everything comes back home. When everything comes back in the place where it's supposed to be. When things are tranquil, calm. The inner struggles are finally calmed down. This is what they felt. They felt that it's Shabbos, which means the fact that it was Shabbos was just a sign that they were in a state of Shabbos. They came full circle. They actually felt they overcame their weaknesses. This is why, right, they drank wine now and not before. They felt they overcame it. All right, yeah. Ishel Re'ehu. The word Re'ehu. Yeah. Yeah, just, it says like this. Let me just, in verse number 33. And they sat down, each one according to his position. Right? If you are more important than the second one, you were first, the other one second, the third one third, and so on and so forth. And they were surprised, Ishel Re'ehu, turning one person to his close friend, Re'ehu, close friend. Doesn't say his brother. Because brothers can hate each other. The word re'ehu implies no hating, just very great closeness. Why is that mentioned? That's the whole point. They all of a sudden discovered in themselves that they finally overcame their weakness. At this point, their sickness is over. It's cured. This is why they start drinking wine again. Yeah.
Why did Yosef go to such great lengths to fulfill prophecy, to make sure the brothers would realize?
What do you mean? Why was it so important to fulfill the prophecy? We spoke about it. Yosef was convinced, and not that he was wrong, he was 100% right. The closer we come to the fulfillment of the prophecies, the more subservient they are going to be to him, to Yosef, the less intense will be the subservience to foreign powers, to Pharaoh namely. Right? Meaning, they could have avoided the whole subservience to Pharaoh had they naturally, right away, had they accepted the subservience to Yosef. Yeah.
So they accept that and they sit close friends to each other.
Ish El Re'ehu. Yeah, but don't forget, it says that each one sat in a different place, right? And they didn't react with jealousy. And then immediately, right, whenever the one verse comes after the another, it's called smichut, which means that one thing is connected with the other. And that feeling of Isha Re'ehu Vaisam Asot Be'et Panav even continued after Binyamin got such a gigantic portion, when they got such a small one, well, when they got a smaller portion than Binyamin, which means that that feeling of Isha Re'ehu continued. Yeah. That was a test, of course. You know, part of the subservience towards Yosef is based on the unity. There can be unity, there is jealousy. He felt that the real fulfillment of the dream is only when the tribes will overcome their weaknesses. In other words, when they'll overcome the divisions among them. That can only happen when the jealousy is finally overcome. Otherwise, there is no real fulfillment of the dream. He was testing. He was testing, of course, yeah. Well, we find it very, very often that sometimes a prophecy represents a guide, a direction, something that you should strive for, right? And the closer you get to it, the closer you are going to come to the consequences of that prophecy. We already mentioned it a few times that there are many prophecies of that sort. Exactly, exactly. It's self-fulfilling. By coming close to the prophecy, you are coming closer to the consequence of the prophecy. The farther away you are from the prophecy, from the fulfillment of the prophecy, the further away you are from the consequences of that prophecy. Sure. Sure, it's not still considered. That is one of the characteristics of prophecies, which means those are guidelines that we are supposed to follow, right? And through that, we are supposed to come to certain goals, right? Yeah, Yeah, there is a relevance. Again, the Chazal say that it has to do with the garments of Mordechai. We're not going to go into it, but if you take a look in the garments of Mordechai, what? Right. Then we know that he also, that there were five different types of garments which represented his importance over the rest of Klal Yisrael. Right. And Mordechai represented the fulfillment of the power of Shevet Binyamin. Because this is what Binyamin is supposed to do, overcome evil. Remember, who is evil? Amalek. Who is Mordechai fighting? Haman. Who is whom? Amalek. Right. So there is a meaning in terms of Ma'aseh Simle Bonim to the five portions. Yeah. Are they mechuyev? Well, are they mechuyev? Of course not. But did they make kiddush? Something similar to kiddush, for sure they made. Yes. Yes. But of course, if you are a nazir, you don't make kiddush on wine.
Right.
What? But so why didn't they do it all these years? Right. You're not answering anything by saying that. That they broke the vows in order to make kiddush. Because it says they didn't taste any wine for years and years.
I'm not saying they broke the vows more than making, I'm saying since they had broken the vows, they're avoiding
breaking. Oh, so of course. So now they make it. You're right. That's correct. Okay, we'll stop here. Good Shabbos. We're going to double Meir if anybody would like to stay.